social justice. I teach the social justice track at Mojón Pardés. That's this wonderful institution. The goal of the class is to very self-consciously try to bridge between Torah and the real world, and to use place to educate about issues that are really pressing in Israel, and to think about them from a Jewish lens. And those people are coming from abroad for the year and don't necessarily have such a deep knowledge of Israel. Here we have like a big mix of people in the room. I'm not going to try to, my goal, I'm going to focus on the Jewish sources a little bit more than I would in the social justice track, but I wanted to to say what we do is we take 30 issues and we look at them Jewishly, and we bring in outside experts, and we go on trips using the area. There are so many things you can do in the area. We go to meet Yossi Abramowitz, who is doing great things with solar energy in our backyard, and Eliezer Jaffe, who started the Israel Free Loan Association, who is in our front yard, and we meet Sari Rifkin, who works across the street and lives on the right, and we and Jean-Marc Lilling takes us on a trip to South Tel Aviv, and we really get a chance to sort of to talk beyond me to people in the field, and really with our eyes and ears and our whole body get a sense of what's going on in Israel. And the theory of it, this is what I really need to prepare for, the theory of it is that I have it on great authority from the great Jewish sociologists that if you don't, the more you know someone true as they are with all of their warts, the more you love them. And anyone who doesn't have anything to complain about being Jewish isn't very engaged. Okay? So a sign of being deeply Jewish is that you can complain about it. And a sign of having a connection with Israel is also that you understand it's not perfect. It's not birthright all year here. And we understand that in an imperfect country, we have struggles and we can fix things. And I try, and we meet people who are fixing things. And it's very inspiring, actually, I'm inspired by meeting people who are fixing things and thinking things are going to be done. But the goal is to look at Israel in a nuanced way and not to be afraid of the imperfection of the Jewish and democratic state. Okay? And everything that we're going to study, it's okay. So Israel's not perfect, but that doesn't mean that we don't love it. I love my mother. My mother is pretty perfect. But and you certainly aren't going to get me to say otherwise. But you'll never get me to say otherwise about my mother, but the state of Israel, I'm willing. Okay, so very quickly. all right, maybe you'll get me to say something not perfect about my mother, but not in this forum. Okay, democracy at work. Very, very quickly. This I would spend probably a good amount of time. This is the Declaration of Independence. There will be total equality of social and political rights for all of its citizens without any distinction based on religion, race, or gender. That is the founding start of our state. I had to add another picture here of Binyamin Eliezer, but I added it, but it's not on this version. It started off just Katsav, and then I added Omer. You could think of it as like, this is not great about democracy, but you think, this is awesome, okay? The law applies to everyone. I wish those things hadn't happened, but I'm happy that when those things happen, that there's accountability in this country. In 1953, we established this country obviously was born in 1948. We had the Declaration of Independence. Welcome. In 1958, Kol Ha'am was a communist paper. They wrote a very controversial article about the Korean War. Communist. It was a communist paper. Ben-Gurion didn't like it. He said, I'm closing down the paper for, I think it was 2 weeks. And the Supreme Court appealed. They appealed, the Kol Ha'am, the paper appealed to the Supreme Court and said, free press, how can you do this? Well, the country doesn't have a constitution. It's never been called a democracy. And based on the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court ruled that since we're a democracy, and as declared in the Declaration of Independence, which doesn't actually use the word democracy, but does use words like freedom, said, sorry, Ben-Gurion, you can't do that. And Ben-Gurion, I really thank him for this, because he was a strong leader, but he backed down. He understood that democracy is based on the balance of powers. And I think that balance of power and that ability to survive without a constitution, we could have lost it right then in 1953. I think if you, after 5 years of the Arab Spring, you can look around and see new democracies are fragile, and we did it. We have this activist Supreme Court. The occupation is difficult for democracy, very difficult for democracy, but the fact that we have a Supreme Court that can be appealed to directly by people under the occupation means that this fence here has been rerouted or stopped in dozens of places. You can think what you want. When we had the social justice protests in, I already lose track of the years. What year was that?
2011.
Okay, so long ago. 2011. 300,000 people. That's like the equivalent of 10 million Americans. And not a single window was broken. I think that is just such a testimony to the power, the culture of protest and democracy in this country. Okay, but that doesn't. So I don't know if all of that was good news. Now I'm getting ready for we have this basic law, which is to protect human dignity and liberty in order to establish. I hate legal speak. In order to establish the state of Israel as a Jewish and democratic state, and one could ask the question, and we are asking this question tonight: Do a Jewish and democratic state go together? Not everyone's in favor of a democratic state. For instance, I have a picture here also of Yitzhak Rabin being assassinated. Not his, just Yitzhak Rabin. Imagine him being assassinated. Imagine here, this is Haredim vandalizing signs because they don't appreciate that there's pictures of women in public places in Jerusalem. One way to respond, as you see here, to things you don't like that's happening in the government is to go out and protest. And another way is to act violently. We have a culture in this country, unfortunately, of responding violently to difficult situations. East Jerusalem is a little depressing. The Arabs in East Jerusalem have the vote, the ability to vote in their community. They don't vote in their community.
They
have the ability to vote in municipal elections, and they don't vote. They vote in percentages close between around 10%, and they don't get very good services. You could say, well, they don't participate in the democracy, but it shouldn't really matter. Okay, Okay, I don't know what to relate to. I actually think this is great. Here we have Salim Jubran. He is our Arab Supreme Court justice. When he was sworn in, this is him during the singing of the national anthem, and he didn't sing. You can say that is instructive lesson to Israeli democracy. That's what Gideon Levy says. Okay, I think I'm pretty sure that the other newspaper said something different. here we have our favorite Hanin Zoabi. I don't know how much I have to say about Hanin Zoabi. Okay, she was on the Mavi Mara. How do you say that again?
Marmara.
I have a real hard time with all those letters. And she came out last summer with, I don't think that the people who kidnapped those three boys are terrorists. She's in our Knesset. Relate to it how you want. 50,000 ultra-Orthodox yeshiva students exempt from the army. That is a product of our democracy. It's a product of a fallible democracy, because they're using their minority, their power as a minority in a way that seems to in my mind, is not good for the country. I would love to press on this and show you but I can't. I'm not allowed to show you the commercial of the, you remember the commercial here, the ultra-Orthodox, the Shas commercial that they had during the previous election, where they had the Russian woman under the chuppah, and she had a fax machine, a gift from Lieberman. You're not Jewish? Now I am. Here's a gift. Yes, it was really funny, but not democracy. Okay, I mean, or it's about party politics, and you can say, is it functional or not functional? So a lot of it is, how do you relate? So look, all I want to say about our struggling democracy is, we're not the only struggling democracy, and the alternatives are not amazing. Okay, so that's, I think, enough about politics, but to sort of think about, why did I pick this topic? Because I had to do we have like a rotation. We get to do the podcast for Parshat HaShavua once. I get to do like 3 or 4 a year. It's a really nice opportunity to say something about Parshat HaShavua. And this week I had Yitro, and I said to my husband, Yoni, who we have a certain relationship. He always tells it exactly like it is. So I said, it's Yitro. I want to do something about how the Ten Commandments all fit together. He said, boring. And you have to focus on the stories. And I'm a little worried about, I think that the juicier topics in thinking about the minorities is not actually democracy. And the first class really is supposed to be, you know, like, wow you. At the risk of being boring, I actually feel... He told me that I had to do this topic. I was actually willing to let go of it. He said, stick with it for 2 reasons. One, it's meant to pull all the classes together for us to understand why do we care about minority rights at all? Okay, minority rights are part of a democratic notion, and so I want to pull all the classes together. And the other is why I feel very passionate about this is because we live in this country where we've got a big group on the left who says about the Jewish and democratic state, I could live without it. And we've got a big group on the right that says that I can live without it. The ones on the left say I can live without it because I don't need Jewish. And the ones on the right say I can live without it because I don't need democratic. And Jewish means not democratic. And that I think that the Pardes world, specifically, has a really important, but a really important mission in trying to argue for the integratability, the possibility of having a Jewish and democratic state. The answer of can we have a Jewish and democratic state has to be yes, and it has to come from here. It has to come from here. So I feel like you can know already where I'm going to go. You know, like, so we'll look at the sources openly. We always look at the sources openly. But I feel like this is some place that we have to come strong with a voice. We have to be able to advocate for a Jewish and democratic state, even though it's not always obvious. First of all, how can you be? As Chanin Zoabi's not totally wrong when she says, what does she say again? When you say Zionism, this means a Jewish state. When you say Jewish state, this means giving privileges to the Jews at the expense of Palestinians. That is not a democracy. Okay, she tells it like it is. There's a reason we don't like her. Okay, it's a challenge. It's something that's very challenging when we want to... What does it mean to have a Jewish state?
Lauren? I don't agree, because England is an Anglican country. Italy is a Catholic country. I'm Canadian. It's not officially a Christian country, but it really is. And as a Jew, I still have rights. And I don't agree it means that minorities have no rights.
I also agree with you, Lauren. Okay, I mean, just take the For sure, but I think but she's not wrong in the sense that we are concerned with the Jewish majority and promoting Jewish. We have a Department for Jewish Values in our Army and multiple such departments for Jewish Values. We promote Jewish settlement explicitly. We concern about creating a Jewish majority explicitly in the North and in the South. So that, what does that mean to me if I'm an Arab Israeli? Right? There's something that is really very challenging. What if I'm Salim Jubran? What am I supposed to do, even if I'm just a, you know, a regular Arab Israeli? What am I supposed to do? Kol obaleva panima nefesh yehudi homia.
There's also obviously institutionalized blatant discrimination.
Forget about the imperfections, the discrimination, the fact that they don't have parks. That's just wrong, right? That needs to be fixed.
But that's clear discrimination.
And clear discrimination. I couldn't agree with you, but that's an imperfection in the system. The question about whether the system itself, right?
But it's by way of God save our gracious queen. I mean, one, assuming you believe in God. Two, assuming that you, you know, really like the queen or the monarch. I mean, but it doesn't demean you if you're an atheist. Doesn't demean you if you're not a monarchist. I just, I don't know. I mean,
I can sit with you, and I can also sit with her.
Most of us have grown up as minorities.
Can I respond to that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So it always bothered me growing up in America. Christmas is a national holiday.
Doesn't bother me.
Okay, but who are you to tell me whether to bother me or not?
Okay.
Like, why should you be able to decide for minorities how much it should bother them that there's an institutionalized recognition of one ethnicity or religion and not theirs?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that we should have a Pledge of Allegiance here like we do in America. It bothers me terribly that there are people in the highest places of government who don't even believe in the right of this country to exist as it does.
Okay, good. So now you brought us to the right. So this is the Hanan Zoabi doesn't want this Jewish and democratic state because she doesn't like the Jewish part. Then you've got the religious right. Okay, now once upon a time that was just the Haredim, but it's not just the Haredim anymore, not even close. Okay, and that is there's a very significant nationalist religious group of our country who thinks we don't have to obey the state. Yehudi lo migaresh Yehudi. Okay, a Jew does not expel another Jew from his house, and I don't care what the government has to say. Where does the Jew get the? Where does the army get the right to tell a Jew that they can't live somewhere in Eretz Yisrael? There's no legitimacy to the secular government. The Jewish government should run according to halakha. Okay, that's a very significant portion of our country. So if you take the 25% on this side and the 20% on that side, okay, so you see why I feel passionate about this. I'm worrying about it from our country because we don't have, I just took the extremes. We don't have enough commitment in our country to the notions of, as Canadians and Americans, right? And like, but we're from other places as well, but we have a sense of democracy be rooted on a broad consensus, and we have to be careful about that on that broad consensus. So, yes.
I just want to point out one statistic. There was a poll taken by Gali Zaha last week with numbers about Jewish Israelis' views towards democracy and Jewishness of the state. Mm-hmm. And a significant majority believe that it's either not Jewish enough or not democratic, that it's not Jewish enough nor democratic enough, but when asked what they would like to see, 41% want to see it more democratic than Jewish, and 31% want to see them equal. So a clear over 70% of Jewish Israelis actually are in favor of democracy or equality between democracy and Judaism.
But that's theoretical. And then when you get down to the practical, right, do you want to have name particular bills as undemocratic or not democratic? I want to be careful. But let's take, do you want to ban the northern front of the
Islamic movement?
Okay. So then you'll get a different sense about, well, in my core, I want to be a democratic state. But when it comes down to this piece of democracy, I'm really more worried about that. Okay, last comment.
Just going back to the discussions about the religious nature of the state, something that I've felt as somebody who grew up as a diaspora Jew and who always identified strongly as a minority and identified with other minorities in Australia, having come here and spent a few years here and having heard some voices, particularly from the right, there is, among Israelis that have grown up here, particularly religious ones, I'm sorry to say, there is a complete lack of awareness of the importance of minority rights. And I've heard people say things like, what kind of democracy is it when you have to give special treatment to a minority? So it's something that I think that Israeli society needs to be a little more aware of.
It's especially true in the Russian immigrant population.
Mm.
Right. Okay, I didn't even put those into there.
What democracy is all about.
And the government, accordingly, right, as if you read the newspapers, there's a question of whether the government's interested in educating on those things. Never mind that the Ezrachut, the, you know this already probably, that the matriculation exam scores for citizenship, Ezrachut, are the lowest at the lowest grade of all of the topics, okay? So it's not for nothing. Okay, so there's a lot going on here. Once upon a time, Rav Kook, Rav Herzog, invested a lot of energy trying to show that we could be a Jewish and democratic state. I want to, like, just a little bit, I want to send you now to Chavrut, it's the Pardes Way, for 10 minutes, to look at what is Jewish government. I'm sorry for those of you who are sick of stories of my children already, but you have to learn with your children for no other reason than just the stories that come from learning with your kids, and also the Bitzel Torah that comes from learning with your kids. But I learned with my middle son, Seder Nezikin, all the Mishnayot of Seder Nezikin, and we had these Mishnayot in Sanhedrin that we learned for the first time, and he learned them for the first time, and he hadn't yet gone to government class because he was 11. It was just stunning stuff. So if you can try to put on your beginner lenses and look at pick apart the sources for the next 10 minutes. What is Jewish government? How is it democratic? And how is it not democratic? Okay, so you can, like, you'll feel the magic of the possibilities of democracy in them, and you'll feel that, well, it's talking about a monarchy, it's not exactly democracy. Okay, so on your marks, get set, do that, and we'll start again. Are we hot? Should I turn down the air conditioning a little bit? Start with the Jewish sources. Skip the first two. The traditional. I'm sorry. Start with Mishnah Avot at the bottom of the page.
So I think what you have is ground flora, ground
Yeah,
Okay, 20 seconds to finish your sentence. Okay, my friends. Someone posted on Facebook. It was no one in this room who posted this on Facebook, but I guess you can all figure. He's actually a very, very smart man, and he complained. He said, this is not going to be a complete treatment of the topic until you discuss this other topic. Let me just tell you up front, there's nothing complete being treated here. Okay, I've got 1 hour. I have so much that I would like to say. I'm trying to resist the desire to just talk at you very, very fast and you can't possibly get anything out of, but just to take a deep breath and that we can all know this is just the tip of the iceberg, a little bit to think about these important questions. Sorry that it's not complete treatment, okay? If you want a complete treatment, you can take my 30 class, and it's still, Pete, you will complain that it is not a complete treatment, but after all, the Torah is infinite. Okay, let's just talk about, and this issue, man, there's a lot to say about this issue. I love these sources. Let's start with the first one. I'll try to go, we have to just go like this. I have to finish these sources in 10 minutes so we can move on to the next thing, so Deborah, you'll be in charge of going like this when it gets to be 10 minutes. Okay. So Rabbi Shimon says, Shloshak Tarimhem. There's three crowns, Keter Torah, Keter Kahuna, the Keter Malchut. You know, it's Mishnah Avot. You know what comes next? Anybody know what comes next?
A good name.
A good name is better than all of them. Kolakavuhut. You two are going to be a woman rabbi soon. Okay, Keter Shem Tov Ole Akulam. So it's supposed to be a nice statement that really has nothing to do with government about how important your reputation is. It's much more important than power. But it teaches us something about power. What does it teach us?
Divide it!
Okay, divide it! First, it's a great democratic principle, balance of powers, separation of powers. Be very suspicious about power. The Torah from the beginning set up multiple power structures because anyone who has too much power will use it incorrectly. We see this in our democracy as well, even though we balance it out. But luckily, some of them go to jail sometimes. Okay, sometimes. I love this Mishnah Sanhedrin. It's not so easy. Were you able to understand it? The Mishnah Sanhedrin, Perek Aleph Mishnah Vav. There's three major pieces to democracy, I think, in this Mishnah, which is about the Sanhedrin. Okay, the big Sanhedrin, the great Sanhedrin, is 71 judges. Okay, a smaller one is 23. And first we have to derive why 71. So why is the 71? Because Moshe, so there's two things. Asfali shivim ish mizikne Israel, v'moshe al gabehen hare shivim v'echad. Okay, you have to gather, Moshe is instructed to gather 70 elders. Why 70 elders? Why that number 70?
70 faces has the Torah.
70 faces has the Torah. Multiple voices. Beautiful. Give me another one. I wanted that first. That's perfect. What's next?
10 sevens. So the idea of the numbers being completeness and fullness of everything. And so if you take that, so you're getting...
No question that that's obviously true. You're also a rabbi. I got a lot of rabbis in this room. How many were there? Was also, do you remember this? Eldad v'Medad v'Navim v'Machaneh. There were two. There were when they appointed the 70. There were two that didn't get in that were outside. Okay, why? That would have given them 72. Why was it important that number of 72? Because Sean said it so beautifully already. Okay, do some division.
Six from each
tribe. Six from each tribe. Okay, so now we've got representative democracy. Is that beautiful? Okay, oh, it's clear. The Midrash says that, but maybe it's already pshat in the Torah, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But it's profound. Mm-hmm. It was important that there be... The elders had to be made up of representatives from every tribe, yes.
Is that in a sense, perhaps even a more sophisticated form of democracy, that each community is represented? So a tribe that is smaller still has the same number of representatives.
Okay,
that's a British.
You're Australian. You're Australian, but the Americans have a lot to say about that.
Yeah.
You know, that's why we need to have... Okay, so obviously we haven't worked that out.
Yeah.
So you see they're already... What?
It's the Senate. It's not
yeah, we've got
well,
the
we've
Senate.
Our Senate
we've got
the also, it's
right, because it's hard. Yeah.
Because
it's complex. How should democracy work? It's a real question. So here we have an idea, in any case, of some sort of representative. Right, the tribes are not equal.
Mm-hmm.
Not even close. Okay. That is the first. The second, the 23 judges. Okay, why 23 judges? Because you need to have Eda Shofetet, the Eda Matzelet, Hare Kanisrim. Okay, you need to have 10 voices who are arguing for one thing, for conviction, and 10 voices who are arguing for acquittal, and you can't have an even number, and so we would get to 21, but wait a minute, then you will never be able to convict, because you need to have a conviction, you have to be to, or here we have, you need to be guilty beyond a shadow of a doubt to be guilty, but you can count that, that's a democratic principle, also to be guilty beyond the shadow of the doubt, so therefore you need 22, but then you can't have an even court, so you need 23. I hope I was able to understand, were you able to understand that? Do you want to ask a question? So you've got 12 judges for conviction, three independent judges, 10 convictors, 10 acquitters, and three independent judges to make it possible to reach a conviction of two, because you need to have a conviction of a majority of two. The democratic principle of... It's not a hard one. Why is that important to us in democracy?
The presumption of
innocence, for sure, guilt beyond a shadow of a doubt, but also the notion of debate and multi-party system and being able to argue with each other as an essential way to get to truth. There's no way to get to truth unless you can really argue it out with each other. You have to have both sides to argue it out. And then finally... acharei rabim lehatot. You need to be able to have majority rules, okay? You have to have the ability to vote and have majority rules. All of the tools of democracy are in here. Can you put on the eyes of an 11-year-old boy and you're like, oh my gosh, our tradition is genius. Really? I mean, you guys, you all sat through government already, you know, like in 11th grade. And so you're like, this stuff is obvious. No, this stuff was before your 11th grade government class. This is where it all came from. Okay? And it's amazing anyway. Okay, kingship. All right, so this is it's all about, so what are we going to do with kingship? Because that's not it. That's not very democratic at all. I really can't do anything to make it right. The tradition is designed to be about, I don't know. Who wants to solve this problem? Boy, I have to. Oh, never mind. The next source is about the executive branch, which is supposed to be a king. Okay, so I'll just point out, Zakovich talked about this, and some of you were there last week, that maybe the Torah doesn't necessarily, it's very ambivalent about kingship. It creates the possibility of kingship, but it doesn't necessarily command you to have a king. Perhaps it's only if you insist. Okay, there's lots of that.
Wasn't it like it's a human weakness that people needed a king, just like they needed to eat meat, and God gave in to them, and from my narrow reading of...
Zakovich talked about that at length and came to that conclusion. He wasn't trying to argue for democracy. Yes?
I was recently in a series of classes, not at Purdue, where several instructors really seemed not only not to feel that the present government was an appropriate form of government for a Jewish state, but to feel that a monarchy that was also a theocracy was a much more appropriate government.
Okay, so we'll see that at the end, right?
But that doesn't sound like Torah supports them so much.
Well, how do I support it? How do you relate to, I understand why he says it, right? Because he's relating already to verse 18. When he sits on his throne, you will write a Torah for him, and he will carry around the Torah everywhere he goes. I'm going to read that in this context. There'll be me and there'll be him, okay? So he's going to say, theocracy, theocracy. I'm going to say, rule of law, rule of law. The king is not above the law. Watch out, Katsav, watch out. Dairy, watch out. Svibar, watch out. Over, watch out. Okay, put them all in there. Okay, the rule that everyone is subject to the law. That's what I would say. And he would say, oh, look, see, it's theocracy. Okay, so I understand where he's coming from. So we have to go there. So that's good. So let's go there already next. I'll just say a couple. So you could say hyper-anti. It seems like perhaps that you could read that as hyper-anti-democracy. You could read that as rule of law. You could, then we've got this other verse. So the verse 15, the harder verse. I've been talking a lot about this verse. For those of you who are worried about women rabbis, this is the worst verse for women rabbis in the Torah. Som tasim alecha melech. You shall pour. If you decide you want a king, then you should surely put a king upon you. Melech, the Sifrei says, melech v'lo malka. Okay, a king and not a queen. And from there, it's obvious that you can't have a woman rabbi. Okay, I can explain that to you in a separate class.
Maybe it's because if it's a king, you know you'll be sorry. If it's a queen, you may like it.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, Dora. Lo tochal letet alecha ish nochri. You cannot have a non-Jewish king, okay? So even if you don't have melech v'lo malkah, that you still have the exclusion of the non-Jew. All right, look, so you could say, if I were Lauren, I would say that doesn't make it an anti-democracy because you have to be born in America to be the president of the United States.
You have to be born to a citizen, not born in the continental or not born within one of the 50 states. You have to be born to a citizen.
You have to be a citizen from birth. Right.
No, you have to be natural born citizen.
Not in Canada. Okay, so look, there's even the United States, the greatest country in the world, is not a perfect democracy. All right, so you don't have to agree with me about that. That's not part of the Torah. And I want to live in this country. So the question of theocracy. What are we going to do about this apparently anti-democratic source? Rav Kook. Because, look, yeah.
The question in verse 14, I mean, is it not possible to see certain elements of democracy in there? So first of all, it's the people who are saying, I'll set a king over me, so there's the idea of the people arguing for a certain form of government, and then, like the nations that are around me, which is that you can also take a look at it. So at that time, monarchy was the norm, whereas today it is not the norm. Although in our neighborhood, we may not want to compare to our geographic neighbors, the nations that we choose to be like them,
to the west instead of the east.
Right, so we could talk about it in those fashions and find democratic value within that pasuk, which is that as we're calling out and comparing ourselves to nations around us, that we are actually calling for that and we have the right to demand that government,
that
form of government.
Awesome. Thank you. I wrote it down.
Even more directly, it says asima alai melech. That's you could imply then that you can remove the king and choose a different one.
Mm. Yeah, the Torah doesn't go for that, but Rav Kook does. Yeah.
The whole limiting feature here is that the king is chosen by God. It's not a matter of you and me deciding who is and who isn't. It's going to be God's choice, which just makes it totally irrelevant to today because God doesn't speak to any of us, even though some people think he does.
Okay, a complete treatment should really go into all the sources of Melech in depth, but I'm not going to try for that. I think this is important. You've raised a lot of important things. Rav Kook says, he asks the question, I love the question, Bichlal, which is, how can you think, how did the Hashmonaim go to war and kill people and send people to their death? What gave them legitimacy as a government? Who said they were kings, right? Because they weren't anointed by God and not by the Sanhedrin and not by the prophets. So where does the legitimacy of that government come from? The question itself is gevaldik, and then we should stop there. But the answer is also great, which is that when there's no king, the power reverts to the people. Okay, which is actually Sean just found it in the Torah for us, that the power reverts to the people, and the people get to decide. And whoever they pick, and this is how you get around women rabbis too, that whoever they pick has legitimate authority. And so if we decide to have a democracy, the people have the power, right? The people have to elect people, and so therefore comes Rav Kook. Democracy is really, given the end of prophecy and the non-existence of the Sanhedrin, democracy is really all we have. It's the mission of the people to take the role of the king and appoint whoever they decide as their designates, as their designees. So that is an argument for democracy, but I'm not ending yet. Okay, I know it's 10 to 9. That would give you a short lecture, but you're not satisfied by this. Now that I, even though I showed you the basis of democracy in our tradition. Not that it's arguing that democracy is the, right, but that you can make an argument. Look, your Haredi teacher wasn't going to say okay to Rav Kook also. You know, so Rav Kook schmuck. Yeah, exactly. Okay, so but for us, a lot of what powerful to us about democracy is not just about balance of power and suspicion of power and voting. There are other democratic values that are very important to us. What are they? Just throw out a few.
Minority rights.
Freedom of the press. Freedom of access to education.
Okay. Mm. What other things?
Personal freedom of marriage. Divorce.
Freedom of religion, freedom of personal status, but equality. Okay, I put all of those things on a source sheet for you. Okay, that's coming around to show you there are all those sources, but I didn't have time to do that because we're not doing a complete treatment. But I wanted to pass a couple to the back there. There's plenty. I wanted to just focus on the last source because I want to, for me, the freedom of speech, the freedom of expression, and the multiple voices is really what's core for this class, to set this class up for the next five classes. And so I wanted to share this one particular source, which is probably familiar to all of you, or to many of you, but I want to share it again with, again, new eyes and think about it from this particular context. It's the story of the deposition of Rabban Gamliel. You remember Rabban Gamliel, his leadership style. What was his leadership style?
Authoritative.
Authoritative, excellent word. His leadership style was very authoritative. He came down with a very heavy hand. And luckily, in the Senate, he was the head of the Sanhedrin in probably, let's say, the year 90. And they decided to depose him. And what really interests me is when they decided to depose him, what did the successor do? Okay, they said, who should we pick? They picked Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah to be the successor. And they went to him at the bottom of page 2 and said, will your honor consent to become the head of the economy? Head of the academy? Gary really getting into me. He says, I have to consult with my people. And he went and consulted his wife. And that is actually the gun in the first scene that proves that's destined for his success. Right? The fact that he turns first to his wife is what makes his success. And it's not just because of his wife. It's because that he turns to consult, right? It's the idea. And that is where we come to what actually happened.
Hashem asked the angels, consult them, shall we meet men?
Beautiful. Okay, so the consulting is essential. So let's see what happens on Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's first day. A Tana taught, Eduyot was formulated on that day. And wherever the expression on that day is used, it refers to that day. Okay, so let's just talk about Eduyot was composed on that day. Eduyot, what do you know about, Eduyot, it's a Masechet in the Mishnah. Okay, what do you guys know about this Masechet in the Mishnah?
A whole lot of laws were passed at one time.
A whole lot, okay, what's the topic of Masechet Eduyot?
Everything,
okay? It is the most scattered topic, the Masechet of the Mishnah. It's composed, it actually has nothing to do with the laws of giving testimony. Rather, it has to do with testimonies, right? It's a collection of testimonies. Who's in there?
Everybody who came and sat in the academy.
Everybody who came and sat in the academy that day. Okay, so that includes Rabbi Hananya Skanikoanim, it includes Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yishmael, of course. But it also includes Shnei Gardiyim Yishar Ashbot. Okay, the trash collectors. And they came and gave testimonies. And the weavers who sat at Sharha at the garbage gate. And they came and gave testimony. But what else is special about Masechet Eduyot. Thank you, Vicky. What else is special about Masechet Eduyot? When was it composed compared to the other Masechetot? It's the very first, this is Olbeck, okay? I don't know if it, but meaning the academics think this, that Masechet Eduyot is the earliest Masechet of the Mishnah. Okay, this, on this day was the day that they began to compose the Mishnah. The Mishnah is, how many jobs, including my own, have been given to us because the survival of the Jewish people is due to the creation, the composition of the Mishnah, which began the most important composition of the Tannaitic period, was composed on that day, was started by Rebbe Elazar ben Azariah. And there was no halakha about which any doubt existed in the Beit Midrash, which was not fully elucidated. What a day it was in the Beit Midrash! Okay, everything, and you can feel it. I left out the paragraph about, I put it in the Hebrew, about how, oh yeah, gosh. Okay, look at the Hebrew for that, the first paragraph on that column. I blew it. Oto hayom salkuhu l'shomer petach. Petach, v'nanu lehem rashut l'talmidim l'ikanes. On that day, they removed the gatekeeper. And they gave permission to all the students to come in. Shaya Rabban Gamliel machriz va'omer, because Rabban Gamliel would stand up and say, "Kol talmid she'en tocho kibbutzo lo yikanes lebeit midrash." Every student she'tocho kibbutzo she'en tocho. What?
It's not inside yet.
Who's inside is not. Oh, the theme of inside outside, right? It's so critical. It's critical actually to the whole class. Okay, but everyone who's inside's not like his outside may not come in. Okay, you may not come in if your inside's not like your outside. This is problematic. Okay, why is it problematic that you can't come in if your inside's not like your outside?
Fraud.
Okay, you're a fraud, I understand. What's the problem with that declaration?
He's leaving it to each person to judge for themselves whether...
I think actually he's judging. Right. He's got the Shomer HaPetach out there. And the problem of that is that he doesn't have a clue what's in your inside, Sarah. Right?
Most
right.
People don't know themselves.
Nachon! Nachon be'emet. But for sure, he can't. He sees your outside and he's judging from your outside whether your inside's like your outside. And he didn't let you in. And he didn't let you in. So that day, they took away the shomer and they let everybody come in. And they came in 400, 700 safsalim, benches. I don't know how many people sat on a bench. I'm going to leave it. I'm going to leave that for now. But it was just an air of tremendous productivity that everything was being fully elucidated. You can imagine the great energy. We feed off, like you feel that I feed off the energy of the students in the class, right? It's the reality of the situation. It's like when the class is looking at their cell phones, I'm telling you, I get more boring. I can't help it. Right? And the fact that everyone came and was participating and was into it made me smarter. And that means that if I give any bad classes, it's your fault. Okay? So everything was solved. All the problems were solved. They were solved by the tremendous energy that the students brought to the class, and they were solved by the fact that everyone came together. And even Rabban Gamliel did not absent himself from the Beit Midrash for a single hour. Okay, even the opposition came and participated and was on the side of the true good. Okay, this is how I know this is not exactly history, okay, but mythical. Because this is almost too good to be true. But it's a beautiful story. Okay, it's a take on history. Maybe not precise. But we have a proof that Rabban Gamliel was there. And I love the proof. The proof, because we have a Mishnah that happened on that day, Bo Bayom, meaning the day that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was appointed. Yehuda Ger Amoni came before them in the Beit Midrash. Yehuda Ger Amoni. Okay, he is himself an oxymoron. And he asks the question, Ma ani mavo b'kahal. What can I join the congregation? Okay, you can cry from this question. Ma ani lavo b'kahal. Because what's the answer to that question?
No.
No. Okay, says Rabban Gamliel, of course not. No, because it says in the Torah, Lo yavo amoni umoavi b'kal Hashem. Did I say that right? Okay, the Torah says, Lo yavo amoni umoavi b'kal Hashem. Yofi. an Ammonite and a Moabite may not join the congregation of the Lord. You can't come, says Rabban Gamliel. Okay, not surprisingly, Rabban Gamliel. But the guy's name, what's the guy's name?
Yehuda.
Yehuda! Okay, that's why he's an oxymoron. Because his name is Jew Geramoni. How can you tell somebody whose name is Jew that he cannot come into the congregation?
Also, and Ammoni's also not allowed to be a gay.
Okay, so he comes in, can I come? And Rabbi Yoshua, Baruch Hashem, Rabbi Yoshua, he says, Botaratza levo b'kahal, you can definitely join the congregation. And Rabbi Kamala was like, what are you talking about? The Torah says no. The Torah says no. You can't blame Rabbi Gamliel, because the Torah says explicitly no. I'm sorry. But Rabbi Yoshua says, we can find a way to include that voice in the Beit Midrash. We can find a way to include that voice in the Beit Midrash. Because after all, yeah?
You switched the English from the Hebrew around. Now I understand what I was saying. The English says that Rabbi Yoshua answers first, and then Rabbi Gamliel answers second.
Okay.
And I'm sitting here thinking to myself, how is this possible? And in the Hebrew, it's Rabbi Gamliel first, the head of the Sanhedrin, makes much more sense. And then Rabbi Yoshua contradicts him.
Uh-huh. Okay, but remember that Rabbi Gamliel has been deposed because it's Bo Bayom, at least in the story. I'm not disagreeing with you, but I think you're right. I take back, but I got the positions right. Rabbi Gamliel is in favor of keeping him out. Rabbi Yoshua says you're welcome first. And Rabbi Yoshua says you're welcome. Mm-hmm. Rabbi Gamliel says, what are you talking about? Can't you read the Torah? Don't you know a verse? Okay, don't you see that it says in the Torah theocracy? Okay, Rabbi Yoshua was like, don't you know how to read a little bit more interpretively? Okay, so it's like, you could just feel that I have precedence for my strong readings. Rabbi Yoshua says, look, we don't really know who's anybody anymore. Okay, do Ammon and Moab still reside in their original homes? Sancheriv came, 722 BCE, and mixed up all the nations, and we have no idea who anybody is anymore. And whoever strays, we assume now that you're part of the majority. Right? Because, like, Batel Barov, okay? Man de Parish, Miruba Parish, okay? The one who comes out of the majority. This is Basar Vachalov for those, right? Straight out of it. Okay, so so Rabbi Gamliel says, so I'm going to leave off the Mishnah. But I leave off the rest of the Mishnah. In the end, they decide to let Yehuda Geramoni join the congregation. When I think about this, I say, like, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, allows Yehuda Geramoni to come and pose his question himself. And I just think, what would have happened if there would have been a Shomer HaPetach there? And he would have written a letter. Because I think there's something that is so very powerful. I can feel it, you know, just in this room myself, knowing all the people in the room and feeling how our questions are different. When you can't, the person who meets, whatever the question is, when you meet the person face to face, and Yehuda Geram, when he asks his question personally, the answer is different. You hear the question differently, more deeply and more powerfully when there's no Shomer HaPetach that is hearing that voice, that is there to allow that voice in. And Rabbi Lazar ben Azaria allowed that voice, that person, that question to be posed. I'm going to try to prove that again in other places. But I think there's something very, it's easy to say, sorry, Judaism doesn't allow homosexuality, than it is to look someone in the eye who is gay and say, I'm sorry, you will live the rest of your life single.
That's okay. Exactly the process the United States has gone through.
When you look the person in the eye and you meet their Yehuda Ger Amuni, and I experience you as Yehuda, the answer has to be different. You experience the question differently. So that is the power of taking away the Shomer HaPetzach. And I was like, think about how the Beit Midrash looks different when Rabbi Lazar ben Azari is in charge. When Rabbi Gamliel is in charge, we didn't have a chance to see all of this. He sits with a microphone, and there's no one else has a voice to speak. What did Rabbi Lazar ben Azaria do here?
He gave to everybody.
Democratic.
Yeah.
The ideal democracy.
The ideal democracy. He took away the Shomer HaPetzach. That's all he does. He takes away the Shomer HaPetzach and lets everyone bring their own voices. And the power of the day is Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Yoshua and Yehuda Ger Amoni and the Shnei Gardiyim Mishara Ashbaot and Rabbi Yehuda Rabbi Hananya Skana Kohanim and Rabbi Yishmael and Rabbi Akiva, all in conversation with each other. That's what allows them to solve all of the problems of the Beit Midrash. It's the multiplicity of the voices and the giving of the space of the voices. And that is democracy. That's what democracy is about to me. And this is, I think, one of the most powerful sources that argues for democracy, for the enabling of different voices to be heard and the power of, it's not just what it does for Yehuda Ger Amoni, it's what it does for all of Am Yisrael that allows us to have Lo Haya, Lo Haita Halacha Shaita Tzluya B'Beit Midrash Shelo Pirshuha. There was no problem that couldn't be solved on that day if we all come together. Okay, so that is that's my argument for democracy. So what I've tried to prove today is two things really, right? That first of all, the need for democracy, the challenge of Jewish and democratic state. It's a very real challenge. The sense that it's not obvious that you need that. I understand why that rabbi said theocratic monarchy. Did you say that right?
Monarchy.
Thank
monarchy.
You. but there's a lot of democratic values within the Torah, and there's a lot of justification for creating a Jewish and democratic state. And there's so, I gave you a source sheet that shows you that many of the values that we have are democratic values. Many of the democratic values we have are also Jewish values, right? We could have made a list of Jewish values and a list of democratic values, things that you would want in a Jewish state and things you would want in a democratic state. You probably would put different things. But once you have this list of democratic values, these are Jewish values. And then I've tried to show you that the most important Jewish value, this important Jewish value, it's so core. I mean, you understood this to begin with, because two Jews, three opinions, and Judaism is all based on asking good questions and discussing and arguing with each other. But from there sprouts truth, from there sprouts productivity, and from there sprouts the growth of Am Yisrael. That is my argument for a Jewish and democratic state, and my argument for five more classes on minority rights. Next week, we will do my 51% minority of women and marriage law. It's a hard class, but I think it's an important one, so I've committed myself to teaching it again. Thank you very much for coming. I'm very happy to hear all the comments. I just want to make sure I end, because it's 9:10.